I don't think I'm alone when I say that I'd rather be in the kitchen than at the gym, right? But if you love food and only kinda sorta maybe like exercising, I have a solution.
Hi, and welcome to Feel the Churn, the only fitness system where you build fat as you burn fat. I'm Jimmy of Pop Soda, and over the next 20 minutes, I'm going to show you aerobics exercises that will yield sweet, creamy butter. You're going to burn 150 calories so that you can ingest 150 calories. Are you ready? Then let's go!
Sound like your kind of workout? Me too. Our producer, Jillian Ferguson, attended a recent butter aerobics class at the Santa Monica Pier. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman. And today on Good Food, we present a bit of DIY food entrepreneuring inspired by Jane Fonda.
I'm at the far west end of the Santa Monica Pier on a Sunday afternoon, standing next to a woman wearing hot pink zebra-striped workout pants. And we're about to churn some butter.
All right. I think we should start setting up and start learning about butter. Why don't you come closer? I'm not gonna bite.
That's Jimmy Fusel on the mic. He's wearing his signature cherry red short shorts, a sweatband around his head, and matching athletic socks pulled about halfway up his calves. His partner, Mike Waite, is behind the DJ booth. They call themselves Pop Soda, and together, they created Feel the Churn, a butter aerobics class that they describe as the stupidest, most inefficient, and funniest way to make butter. Zebra Stripes and I are standing in a crowd of about 50 people. Everyone is holding a jar of cream in each hand.
So, if everybody's pretty limber, first thing to do is check your jars and make sure they're nice and sealed and tight. And then I would encourage you to put your arms out and make sure it doesn't hit anybody in the face. Are you ready? We're gonna start off slow, all right? Here we go. Let's just march out.
We begin marching in place, moving our jars of cream up and down as we go. Each plastic jar is filled about two-thirds full with cream that sloshes around with every movement. Jimmy leads us effortlessly through a coordinated dance of arm movements, side steps, and jumping, while Mike speeds up the music.
And we play music that is encouraging for making butter, which basically means that every song that we play has the word shake in it. Shake it up.
Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. Mike and Jimmy play in a band together. Their love of music, combined with a love for food, inspired them to create Feel the Churn. Plus, there was this girl.
Before I met my wife, she was my girlfriend. And before she was my girlfriend, she was this girl I was interested in, and she baked bread. And I thought the best way to impress her was to learn how to make butter, so I did that, and then I realized briefly thereafter through Shake Weight commercials partially that there was a workout opportunity there, and Mike and I wrote some music that was workout music, some electronic body music, as it's known, and it went great, so we kept doing it.
The duo first workshopped their routine in 2012 at Machine Projects, an arts incubator in Silver Lake. Since then, they've performed in New York, Philadelphia, and next week, Pop Soda will teach a butter aerobics class at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. Shake it, shake it. At Feel the Churn, you see results a whole lot faster than you do at any other exercise class. After a good 15 minutes of shaking my jar, the milk is separating into liquids and solids. The music fades down, and we all line up as volunteers help to strain and package our hard-earned butter. Allie Kirshner is one of the volunteers.
I am pouring the congealed butter and buttermilk into the strainer, and then we're separating the liquid from the solid butter.
She gently presses the solids with a flat wooden spoon to extract all the liquid.
And then once it's formed into a nice ball, my colleague is going to line the butter press with some cellophane so it doesn't stick to the sides. And we'll place it in there. She'll push it down to give it a nice square shape and wrap it up, and you're good to go.
Now the only thing left to do is eat it. Feel the Churn burns about 150 to 200 calories.
And that equates exactly to a slice of toast with butter on it.
For those who can't wait to cash in their calories, a mobile bread oven is parked on the other end of the pier. Other churners, they're saving their butter for something special.
Biscuits, my favorite thing in the world.
We were talking about making a pie.
bread for sure.
Yeah, probably bread and cook with it.
French toast, 100%, and buttermilk biscuits.
Is there more satisfaction or excitement about maybe baking or eating once you've made your own product, do you think?
Yeah, I feel like this is something you could do with your family, you know, and that's what makes it exciting. So we're trying to take pictures and show the kids, this is something we can do, and then we're going to make pancakes. Let's do it, you know, yeah. So I think they're going to be super excited.
The general vibe post-butter aerobics is near euphoric. Maybe it's the endorphins, or maybe it's just childlike glee for the campy nature of it all. But either way, euphoria, Mike says, is a natural byproduct of Feel the Churn.
We have found that as you break down the protein barriers that enslave your butter in the buttermilk, that you can also break down barriers between people, and that you see some really suspicious, grumpy people walking in, and they walk out with smiles on their faces and hands full of butter, and that's no joke.
They do get possessive about their butter, though. They want their butter. This is the butter I made, right? And so they're not going home with somebody else's butter, that's for sure.
For Good Food, I'm Jillian Ferguson. Let's dance, let's shout, shake your body down to the ground. Let's dance, let's shout, shake your body down to the ground. Let's dance, let's shout, shake your body down to the ground. Let's dance, let's shout, shake your body down to the ground. Check out photos and videos of Pop Soda's Feel the Churn Butter Aerobics class at the Good Food blog. Up next, we have a heartwarming story from an unlikely place. Stay close. This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. Rwanda. The name brings to mind the worst horrors we humans harbor within ourselves. And yet, after reading Josh Ruxin's book, A Thousand Hills to Heaven, I no longer have that only association. Josh is a public health expert. He teaches at Columbia and works in Africa with boots on the ground, as they say, all while running Rwanda Works and Health Builders, both companies committed to building health infrastructure in very difficult places with the hope that they will continue to give needed services once they leave. On the side, yes, there is a side. He helps his wife, Alyssa, with a Project Heaven, a restaurant in Kigali where they live. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Evan.
What brought you to Rwanda?
Well, initially, I became interested in Rwanda well over 14, 15 years ago when I was working in the private sector with the government and started to hear how the government of Rwanda was talking. This is just a few years after the 1994 genocide. Heard them start talking about their ambitions for the future. And in particular, heard the government say very clearly, in the long term, we don't want aid. In the long term, we want to be the Singapore of Africa. So initially, I went to Rwanda to implement the Millennium Village Project, which is a massive poverty reduction program. And we started doing that at the very epicenter of the 94 genocide in a place called Mayanje.
So let's talk a little bit about where hunger sits in all of this. When you identified the location of the Millennium Village, not only had it been crushed by the genocide, but it was crushed for food creation because of decades of elephants, I understand, pounding the earth.
Well, Mayanje was in bad shape for a lot of reasons. Much of it is tied in part to global warming and deforestation. And as a result, the layer of topsoil that had once been there was gone. And the farmers were experiencing terrible droughts. And against that backdrop, there was no way in which people were able to progress. Imagine that at that time, we had kids who were dying in the community on a weekly basis from malaria, from diarrheal disease. We had adults who were dropping dead from all sorts of chronic illness, among them AIDS. And essentially, it was a community that had been decimated.
Before the community was able to get itself together, you first had to deal with hunger. That's sort of your rule number one.
Yeah, one of my observations in working in development is it's not terribly helpful to tell poor people, to do something different, to start up a business, to take out a loan when they're suffering from tremendous hunger and the onslaught of disease. So that was actually the very first move we made, was to ensure that there was a stable supply of food in the community. And that took us about a year to get that in place.
You say that in a few sentences, but the actual work of just starting this emergency feeding is a project. For example, when you apply to the World Food Program to bring massive amounts of food help into an area, you have to pass through certain hoops. The UN has to decide that those who are extremely skinny are skinny enough. How do they do that?
Well, that is done with an armband measurement that acknowledges whether a child is severely malnourished or chronically malnourished. And when we initially did that in Mayanje, we found that more than a third of the community was chronically to severely malnourished, and we didn't actually meet the UN guideline for receiving food support. But with a couple carefully placed phone calls, we were able to get the World Food Program to actually come in. And that was really a turning point for the whole community.
So the food arrives. The children immediately start being fed. How long is it before you can actually visually see a difference in the energy of the community?
Roughly overnight.
Wow.
It was harrowing to just be there the first days and the first weeks when we started emergency feeding, because it looked actually a lot like what got me interested in development in Africa in the first place, which was the Ethiopian famine of 1984 and 1985. And I had the chance to go to Ethiopia a couple years after. And so the classic bloated bellies that flash across our TVs even to this day in order to raise funds for various international efforts, that is what it looked like. And as soon as that nutrition was being delivered, then everyone's energy changed. And we who from the outside, and by the way, this was a Rwandan-led team for the most part, who had been suggesting all sorts of new interventions like planting fields with line planting techniques and progressively terracing the fields to preserve whatever organic material would otherwise wash down the hillside. People hadn't heeded what we'd been saying until their bellies were full. As soon as they were sated, they were ready to work and ready to come together and lead the efforts. And there was this incredible moment where one of the community leaders approached me. She had actually been in charge of organizing funerals for children who had died over the years in the community, as I said, on a weekly basis. And she grabbed me one day, this is a couple months into our efforts, and she said, "I'm mad at you." I said, "Why are you mad at me?" She said, this is Jacqueline, she said, "I'm mad at you because you've put me out of business. I used to have a great funeral business, and no one dies here anymore."
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Josh Ruxin, author of A Thousand Hills to Heaven. His book chronicles his experience working to build a health infrastructure in Rwanda. In it, he describes the key role of local agriculture.
Well, cassava had long been the staple crop of Africa, but there was a terrible blight which, during the 1990s in particular, had taken out much of the cassava production. And this is really a hunger crop. It's a tuber. It's in the ground. So you can choose to harvest it today or harvest it next year and get these massive tubers of cassava, or manioc, as many people know it. It's not terribly nutritious, but it does fill up the belly, and it can be converted into flour and bread. But the community in Mayanje and across Rwanda had actually lost their cassava crops, and we needed to very quickly replicate a disease-resistant crop so that there would be a new hunger crop. And then there were a number of other crops that came along, everything from fruit trees like mangoes, which continue to thrive in Mayanje. And we've got farmers who are literally today just, about 8 years out, making some of them more than $10,000 a year on fruit that they're selling in Kigali from these trees that were put in during these early years.
Put that $10,000 a year in perspective.
It's a king's ransom in a country like Rwanda, where per capita income is just now approaching $1,000 per capita, but where really there's a massive band of very wealthy people who probably earn $10,000 and up, and a lot of people who might earn less than $200 a year. That kind of money is completely another level of development and enables not just a family, but an entire community to get on its feet and advance.
One of my favorite stories in the book was once cassava had been planted at a different strain that did not have the blight and was so successful that they realized they could export it, and a distribution system was born. And this is your basic focus, isn't it? This idea of getting people to a place where they're healthy enough where they just start creating many, many micro-businesses.
In countries where the government actually cares about development, there are these incredible opportunities right now for ending hunger and enabling people to advance themselves through business. And while I was doing the work out in Mayanje, my wife was back in Kigali working with the orphans of the genocide and starting up her own social enterprise, a business and restaurant called Heaven. And what I saw through that lens of the restaurant was that it doesn't really matter where people live in the world. It doesn't matter whether it's a rich country or a poor country. Everyone wants a job, and they want the ability, of course, to be able to pay for their health care and for their kids' education and for a roof over their heads and over their grandparents' heads. And the beauty of a place like Rwanda and lots of sub-Saharan Africa is when I talk about the creation of, say, service industry jobs, I think in our country, in the U.S., lots of service industry jobs are viewed as low wage and part of a cycle of poverty. But actually, in a place like Rwanda, a service job is something to aspire to because, I'll give you an example, the front of house manager for Heaven Restaurant just managed to put himself through university based on what he was earning as our head of service, and has paid for half a dozen of his siblings to go through primary and secondary school back at home, and has been able to cover all sorts of family expenses. So it's actually a middle-class job in a place like Rwanda that has this tremendous multiplier effect. I mean, one job created through business that is ethical and responsible has downstream benefits for dozens and dozens of people. And I can't point to anything in, say, traditional aid or charity that pays off dividends permanently like that.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Josh Ruxin. His book, which is incredibly readable and just filled with incredible stories, is called A Thousand Hills to Heaven. California's in the midst of a major drought. 2013 was the driest year on record. And so far, 2014 isn't getting much wetter. Laura Avery's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a report on how farmers are coping.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're enjoying sunny weather here in Southern California, but the real news is that the state is in a very, very serious drought situation. And what better way to find out about the effects of the immediate and long-term drought effects than by talking to farmers whose livelihood depends on irrigating the wonderful food they bring to us at the market every week. So starting in the Central Valley in Reedley, which is sort of the heart of all the farming activity in California, Troy Regeer is a second-generation family farmer, comes to the markets, year-round with fruit. And Troy, you're a family farmer. Tell us how the drought is affecting you and what is your outlook?
Well, right now we don't have hardly any rain this year. No snow in the mountains that we really need to fill up the lakes and the reservoirs so we can get our water allotment through the irrigation district that we're in. And we really probably use 3/4 of the water during the summer for our peaches through some of the lakes and stuff. And what I'm hearing now is they might not have any water for us at this point because they need to fill up the lake first. And we have had 2 previous dry years, and they've kind of used their allotment up. So what that means is we're going to have to pump more water from our wells, and that costs money. And a lot of them are going dry or pumping less. And so all the pump guys that are in the business of drilling and servicing wells are backed up for 2 years. So if something does go wrong, you're on a waiting list. And it's getting kind of scary because in the summer when it's 110 and we need water for peaches and stuff like that, it's scary to think of what might happen at that point.
So no matter how long you've been getting water from these lakes, there's a chance you would just get none?
From what I'm hearing, we might get none. And that means more pumping. And like I say, the pumps are pumping less because the water table is going down. And it's scary because you have to go deeper, and the pump guys are already, there's already wells going dry last year. So if you're not in a good location that has a good access to your aquifer, you know, the depth, you have to go deeper, then you could be on a waiting list and you can lose a lot of trees and fruit.
Is there any rain in the forecast?
I haven't seen any rain in the forecast. Have you?
No.
I mean, there's beautiful days. The other part that we worry about is the sun during the day. I mean, we have the chilling hours at night for the peaches, which they need in dormant. But the sun kind of confuses the peaches. And if they start budding too early and flower and get in that flowering stage too early, chances are we'll have late frost and freezes during flowering stage, and that's dangerous too. So there's like 2 scenarios going on what's going to happen with stone fruit this year, and everybody's waiting to see.
Yeah, well, this is very grim news. Sorry to say, but it's a giant, you know, global issue at this point. So, well, we will stay tuned and we'll check back with you later, Troy.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Troy Regeer. He is a family farmer from Reedley, and he grows mandarin citrus in the winter and then the wonderful peaches all summer long. Now we're going to go to a different region in California. It's the Three Rivers area just west of Visalia at the foothills of Sequoia National Park. And that's where Florabella Farm is located. And I'm talking to Dawn Cantor, who, along with James Birch, operate the beautiful organic Florabella Farm. Dawn, tell us what your water situation is like up there.
This summer, for the first time in 25 years, we actually ran out of water in the Cahuilla North Fork River, and that's what we use to water our crops. And the Cahuilla River gets its water from snowmelt off the Sierra Nevadas. So what we had to do, we do have a well, but it's not a big producing well, it's just for our house. What we had to do to save our crops, we had to let many, many crops die, and we had to water with garden hoses, which meant my husband had to go out and move water every 3 hours around the clock for 8 weeks. More worrisome, well, equally worrisome as the drought, was the influx of wild animals that we had come and eat all of our crops. Generally, they eat about 10%, and we're okay with that. But since there's no greenery up on the hills, they have no food. So every night, there's between 8 and 12 deer at each of our ranches. We have no lettuce at all because we can't keep them off of it. And so now we're in the process of building a deer fence for the first time. We're also practicing some big water conservation things. We have now over 6,000 square feet of greenhouse, and we're growing row crops in it for the first time because we can use drip irrigation, and it gets very misty in there at night as it evaporates and it drops back down on it. And we're wondering if that's our future. Mm-hmm. It's devastating. We really, if we don't get rain, we do not know how we're going to grow food.
If it rains this winter, which we don't know if it will or not, will one good rainy spell help?
It'll only help for the short term. What our particular farm needs is snowpack, which takes months and months, because you get a little snow, then you get a warm day, and some of it disappears. So it takes the whole winter to build up the snowpack. We're talking to a well digging company about possibly putting in a new well, mm-hmm. but that's not a cure, because the wells depend on the aquifers, and the aquifers are going dry. So there hasn't been enough rain falling on the land to replenish the aquifers. We've never seen anything like this, and we're scared, we're nervous, we do not know what our future is.
Right, so for now we're just kind of dealing with it on the short term, running around with hoses, moving them every 3 hours, and just working extra, extra hard.
And praying for rain, mm-hmm. literally praying for rain.
Right, yeah. All right, Dawn, well, we are going to keep watching and following, and of course you're going to communicate with your customers, and we'll all know about it. And this should be something everybody should be doing, water conservation, no matter where they live.
Even water conservation, going into a restaurant and letting them give you a glass of water that you're not going to drink. It takes them 8 glasses of water to wash that glass. Mm-hmm. So if everyone does their share, maybe California can see its way through the drought.
I sure hope so, because we're feeding a lot of people. Good food, too. All right, Dawn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Dawn Cantor from Florabella Farm. Her farm is located in Three Rivers at the foothills of the Sequoia and the Sierras. And like she was saying, with no snowpack, they are not going to have any water for their reservoirs, their lakes, and their crops. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
The word drought is just making headlines now. But about a year ago, I started hearing from ranching friends in Central California that they wouldn't be putting any more cattle on the land. Apparently, cattle are the canary in the coal mine for California drought conditions. Vinnie Tong is a freelance reporter and producer. Recently, she's been meeting with ranchers and farmers in the state. Hi, Vinnie.
Hi, Evan.
Why is cattle such an indicator for drought?
You know, they're a first indicator because they use unmanaged water supplies like creeks and streams. This is where livestock is drinking from. You know, surface water is what nourishes the plants to grow, and they also get water from there. But, you know, if you think about it, ranchers can't irrigate. So, in a sense, when there's not enough rain, cows are going to be thirsty.
I understand that people not only are not putting new cattle on the land, but they're actually thinning their herds.
Yeah, that's true. I've talked to a couple ranchers. Both have told me they've had to cut their herds. In some cases, this means, you know, selling cattle early when it's, you know, not, quote, finished yet. Sometimes it means selling them at a loss. You know, the rancher I spoke to in San Juan Bautista, he's cut his herd by 50%. It got so bad in the fall that he was spending his days for 6 weeks trucking tap water to his cows, literally taking a hose, filling up tanks, and driving it around to his cows 3 times a day. And he's having to start to think about, is he going to have to pass on some of this cost to his customers? You know, he mentioned the possibility of a drought surcharge this spring. And, you know, it's really worrisome. He's been in business for more than 2 decades, and he says he's never seen anything like this before.
Thank you so much, Vinnie.
Thank you.
That was Vinnie Tong, a freelance reporter and producer. She's recently been meeting with ranchers and farmers all over the state. We understand that drought means no water falling from the sky. But why does that happen? And particularly here in California, what climactic forces are at work to cause rain and snow to move around us on its way elsewhere? Paul Rogers is a journalist with the San Jose Mercury News. He covers resources and environmental issues. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm so curious to know that what is happening in the atmosphere to keep us so dry?
Well, normally in the winter, as most Californians know, we get a lot of our rainfall that comes in from the Pacific Ocean. We have storms that are brought in from the jet stream, and they dump fairly regular rain between November and most Marches or Aprils. And what's happened this year is that we have a really historic and unusual weather pattern that has erupted over the Pacific Ocean, and it's really something that is unprecedented in modern weather records. What's happened is a giant mountain, really, of high-pressure air in the atmosphere that's running about 4 miles high and 2,000 miles long. Think of it as almost like the Sierra Nevadas, but just of made out of air, is sitting off of California all the way down to Baja California, and it's blocking the storms that normally come in and give our state rain in the winter. Those storms are being sent north when they hit this ridge of high-pressure air, and all the rain is going up into Alaska and Canada and then being sucked down into the middle of the country.
I understand that someone has dubbed this the ridiculously resilient ridge.
Yeah, there's a meteorologist at Stanford who's given it that name. It's sort of funny in some ways, but then it's also kind of ominous. This particular fellow, Daniel Swain, his name is, has looked at weather records going back to 1948 when we first got modern weather balloons and satellites that measure barometric pressure in modern ways. And he has found nothing like this in the record. The closest example is 1976-77, which, as many longtime Californians remember, was one of the worst droughts of the 20th century. Unfortunately, this ridge right now that we've had out there now for 13 months is stronger and larger than the one in 1976 and 77.
And how long did it take that one to go away?
Well, luckily, that one wasn't out there for that long. The 76-77 drought was a quick drought. It was only a two-year drought. The problem back then was there was very, very little rainfall, hardly any at all. But in the last year, 2013, our rainfall totals even broke those records. So typically, Los Angeles and San Jose, where I am, both get about 15 inches of rain a year. That's the same amount as Casablanca, Morocco. So we live in a dry state anyway. But when you look at our rainfall total in 2013, each city, Los Angeles and San Jose, both got about 3 inches of rain. So not only were we way below our norm, but we broke the records from 76, 77, and other dry years. You know, I think scientists can tell us generally how these kind of phenomenon are created. In this case, they don't know when this ridiculously resilient ridge is going to go away. They don't know what exactly will make it break down, and they don't know why it's more persistent this year than other years. There's some theories, but nobody knows for sure.
You've made what can be incredibly arcane much clearer. Thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
That was Paul Rogers. He's a journalist with the San Jose Mercury News. He covers resources and environmental issues, which is why we asked him here today. In a minute, how bartenders craft a new cocktail. Plus, Tennessee Williams, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, some of the best American writers wrecked their life with alcohol. We explore what role the bottle played in literature next.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. For some, beer is a cold swig from a bottle after a long, hot day. For others, it's part of an increasingly large pantry of ingredients available to create a fine, sippable cocktail. Christiane Rolick creates the bar programs for Suzanne Gohan and Carolyn Stein's restaurants, Luke, AOC, and Tavern. His cocktail, The Pinkerton, got us sipping and thinking about beer cocktails. Christiane is one of the L.A. barmen who's at the forefront of changing L.A.'s craft cocktail menu. Hi.
Good morning.
It's so great to have you here.
It's a pleasure. It's my pleasure.
So let's talk about that Pinkerton.
Yes, you enjoyed it, huh?
Oh, it was really fantastic. What restaurant do you serve that in?
AOC.
Now, how do you go about deciding which cocktail is going to be appropriate for which
restaurant?
Yeah.
Depends on the people who come to the restaurant. Are they interested in experimenting with new stuff, experimenting with different stuff? Because there's beer in the cocktail, there's Genever in the cocktail.
What is Genever?
I grew up with Genever, and for most Dutch people, it's part of growing up. But in the United States, it kind of got lost after the Prohibition, and now it just came back, and it's a grain spirit. It's a malted wine that's distilled. And basically what happened, the Dutch were distilling this malt wine and it tastes like crap. So they had to, what are we going to do with this? So they added juniper to it. And juniper in Dutch is Genever. It's very malty. That's why I thought about using beer with it, because it has a very malty, distinguished flavor, and beer does as well. So I thought the two might either complement each other, or it might be a total fiasco, and it kind of worked together.
Because those are the two star ingredients of the Pinkerton.
Yes, I have a stout that's toasted. Basically, it's a beer that's made with toasted barley, and you have Genever. But one of the key ingredients is, or the third key ingredients is molasses. And molasses is the side product, basically, when people make sugar. And most people just discard it, and they use sugar to sweeten your coffee or your tea or whatever. But the side product is the interesting thing, because that has all the vitamins, all the nutrients that's in sugar cane. That's the molasses, and it has a very distinct flavor. And now, as a kid, I grew up putting that on pancakes and apple molasses. So I thought I grew up with Genever. What else flavor could I add to that? The molasses would be good. And the beer actually came in last, because I wasn't sure I wasn't going to use that. I started with Genever, added the apple juice, fresh apples, lime juice as an acid, and then the blackstrap molasses. And then I just had a dark drink. And, you know, a drink has to be presentable. You can't just say, here's my dark drink, you know, enjoy it. So what are you going to add? You're going to add egg whites, make it like a, give it a velvety mouthfeel.
And then it would look like a cappuccino.
Exactly. Or, but like the thing is, if you put egg white in, it, say like you put half an ounce of egg white in it, you lose half ounce of space in your cocktail that does not have flavor. It does have texture though, egg white. So I wanted to find something else that gives a velvety texture and has flavor. And that's where the stout came in. And because the stout has protein, has starch, which stabilizes foam normally. I started shaking it. And it worked really well.
This is the first time anybody has ever actually gone through a cocktail recipe with us and let us look into your mind about how it's done. That's fascinating. And what really fascinates me is how you also focus on the nutrition of all, each aspect.
Well, I work for Suzanne Goen. That comes with the territory.
I want to go back to the way you develop cocktails for each restaurant. How would you describe how you get inspired to create new drinks?
Before I took over the cocktail program, I was bartending at Luke, and I was just paying my way through college. I went to El Camino College, actually, in the South Bay, and studying something totally not related, and I was just bartending, and I had a great time bartending, because we had a bar meeting, I remember, and they said, come up with a cocktail. And I asked, what can I use? Anything. And suddenly, like, all these lights went off. Anything? So I went into the walk-in at Luke, and there's tons of produce, all the freshest stuff that just came from the market. And I was like, I can use this, I can use that. And it was like a kids in a toy store.
Do you remember what that first cocktail was?
We called it a greenhound. It was muddled cucumber with grapefruit and vodka and a little lime juice and sugar. And that was it. And it was very refreshing, very easy to drink, and yeah, it just sold like cupcakes. But that was my first cocktail. And then from there on, you know, you started experimenting with making my own bitters. How can you make your own orange liqueur? Like, what if I do vodka and brandy and some sugar and some orange and, you know, see how that works? It's like math. It's like you make a formula and you put something in, then you have to take something out. If I take sugar out somewhere, I have to put in some sweet somewhere else, because otherwise I have a sour drink.
So, Christian, what was the subject that you were studying in college? What was your major?
Respiratory therapy.
Wow. You gave it all up for drinks.
Yes. Well, it's an interesting thing, because an RT is the one who's called last. If everything fails, that's the guy they call, keep him breathing.
And cocktails are sort of the exact opposite of that.
Exactly. It's such a part of enjoying life, and it's nice to be part of that. It's a whole different way of looking at things.
This has been such an immense pleasure for me. Thank you so much.
It's really all my pleasure. I can't believe I'm at KCRW.
That was Christian Rolick. He is the man behind the cocktails and the bar programs at Suzanne Goen and Carolyn Stein's Luke, AOC, and Tavern. We'll have the recipe for the Pinkerton on our blog. Some of the greatest writers in the canon of American literature wrecked their lives with alcohol. John Berryman, Raymond Carver, John Cheever, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, Tennessee Williams, each one a brilliant observer, able to craft an exquisite and painful view of the American experience. Olivia Lang is a talented writer and a critic. In her latest book, The Trip to Echo Spring, Lane recounts her literary journey across the U.S., tracking the role that alcohol played in the lives of these extraordinary writers. Hi, Olivia.
Hi.
This is such an absolutely unique and strange and wonderful book. This idea of wanting to journey through literary America, the literary America of these particular men, you write, was sparked by your desire to think about alcohol. Why?
Part of it was I felt as somebody who's worked in literature, who's been a writer, who's been a critic, that there was an untold story about the role of alcohol in literature. And then there was a more personal element to it too, which is that I grew up in an alcoholic family myself, and I encountered Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof as a teenager at about the age of 17. And from the minute I opened it up, I felt like it's a play about an alcoholic family and an alcoholic son and his parents and his wife and siblings, the dynamics between them all. And it really hit home to me. It felt like, gosh, this is it. This is what an alcoholic experience is like. This is what an alcoholic home environment is like. And here it is on the page. Somebody's sort of broken that taboo of silence that is so prevalent among alcoholic families and set it down. And so from that point on, I became absolutely fascinated in what writers had to say about drinking. And as I got a little bit older, it dawned on me that many of those writers who had written so brilliantly about alcoholism were themselves alcoholics. And that became just a fascinating subject to me, how that worked, how it worked in their own lives, how it worked in their work, and what sort of story could be built about it.
You begin your journey in New York City at the Elysee, the hotel where Tennessee Williams died. How did you choose which authors you wanted to feature and the particular itinerary that you took to follow their lives?
I chose the six. I started with Tennessee Williams. I knew he had to be in it. He was the essential character for me. And then I wanted people who had a similar sort, had sort of connections between them, had been friends with each other, had known each other, had mentored each other. So those sort of cross connections were important. And then the other thing is that it was really important to me that they were people whose writing I thought was extraordinary, because I was aware that I was going to be ploughing up all sorts of dark elements of their lives, all sorts of bad behaviour. And I didn't want to come in and expose them. I didn't want to just do a hatchet job on them all, which I think you could easily do and would be a very unpleasant book. It wasn't something I wanted to do at all. So I needed that sort of backdrop of really relishing their work, really appreciating their work. And then the itinerary itself, what I did was basically I wanted to follow the trajectory of alcoholism. That's the sort of drive of the book. So it starts with these intoxicating stories of early drinking, and then it builds up to full-blown alcoholism, stories of people's catastrophes, which is the suicides, Hemingway and John Berryman. But I didn't want to end there. I wanted to end with recovery. I wanted to end with people who managed to get sober. Once I'd sort of clarified that in my head, I then plotted it out across a map of America to work out the itinerary that I'd follow. So I went to places where people drank, where people lived, to landscapes that matter to them. I wanted to sort of follow that route through. And the reason I wanted to make a journey, a physical journey, is because landscape mattered to all of these men a great deal. And it seemed to me that their relationship with landscape represented their better selves, if I was looking at their drinking and their worse selves, this was the flip side to it. This was the loving, the sensitive, the nourished, the open aspect of them. And so that landscape was really important to me. It was really important to go and visit it, to see it for myself.
In particular, the exploration you do of John Cheever's story, The Swimmer, is really powerful. For those of us who may have read it a very long time ago or never read it, could you sort of take us through what it's about and what you think John Cheever is trying to achieve through the character?
Absolutely. It's such a wonderful story. It's very, very short. It starts with a man called Neddy Merrill waking up after a party at a neighbor's house. He's been drinking a lot. He says, "We drank too much last night." And he has this wonderful idea. He comes out and there's the pool and he thinks, "I'll swim home to my house by way of the neighbor's swimming pools." He figures it's a few miles, maybe slightly less, and that he can just swim pool by pool across the country. And this seems absolutely magical to him. So he sets off, and inevitably, it's a Sunday morning, his neighbours are having parties, so he can stop off and have drinks as he goes. And he has a few gins on one terrace and moves on to the next, doing his laps as he goes. Then things start to get a little bit odd. It's summer, but now it seems a lot colder. Suddenly it seems almost autumnal. It's the same day. The houses start to seem more abandoned. The people he encounters seem more hostile. There's little suggestions that things have gone wrong in his life. We have this strong sense that time is moving fast past us, faster than it is possible. It's a very surreal story. And it ends with Neddy Merrill in his trunks, freezing cold, in this wintry weather, walking up the driveway to his own house, which is locked and barred. It is apparent it has been empty for a very, very long time. And this is a story about an alcoholic's downfall, written in the strangest way possible. It's very much John Cheever's own story. It's magical to read, but it's also very disturbing because it is something that he lived through himself.
And I guess I need to ask about the title of your book, Echo Spring. What does that mean? Where does it come from?
Echo Spring. Echo Spring is literally a brand of bourbon, a brand of Kentucky bourbon. And the line comes from the play Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams' wonderful play. And the alcoholic Brick, who's a retired football hero, and he's on crutches, he's injured his leg, messing around drunk, actually. And he keeps walking to the hobbling to the liquor cabinet over and over again through the play. And his wife, Maggie the cat, says, "What are you doing?" And he keeps saying, "I'm just making a little short trip to Echo Spring." And he means, "I'm walking to the liquor cabinet," but he also means, "I'm escaping. I'm going somewhere peaceful. I'm going to this lovely place, Echo Spring, this place where all of these worries and concerns can't catch up with me." And that was what I was fascinated by, that sort of symbolic sense of alcoholism, that it's a way out. It can seem like the most magical way out possible. And then it starts developing all of these appalling consequences until it becomes an absolute prison.
Of these six men, did any manage to recover?
Yes, they did. John Cheever managed to get dry and Raymond Carver managed to get dry. And both of them managed to keep writing after they got sober as well, which I think is very important. So John Cheever wrote his extraordinary novel Faulkner, which is kind of based on his own recovery experiences. It's about a heroin addict in prison. And Raymond Carver also hit absolute rock bottom and then pulled himself back from the brink. And he had these sober years, sober decade, where he described it as his second life. And I think he genuinely felt like he'd come back from the grave. It was that powerful for him.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
That was Olivia Lang. Her book is The Trip to Echo Spring on Writers and Drinking. Jonathan Gold is in the studio with me next, raving about a new restaurant in downtown LA. Stay close.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q, Q
KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Jonathan Gold is here with me. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and the eyes and ears of the LA restaurant scene here at Good Food. This week, we're heading back to, surprise, surprise, the Arts District in downtown LA.
There's a lot of restaurants there now.
A lot of restaurants, and just it seems like every week or two there's something new. Which one is this?
This one is, if I were pressed, maybe my favorite so far. It's a new place called Factory Kitchen, and the chef is Angelo Oriano, who spent a trillion years, well, 18 years, but in chef years, 18 is a trillion, at Valentino, where he was the head chef.
Such a fine chef.
There's nothing about Italian cooking he doesn't know, I think. And there's something about the place that makes it seem comfortable to go into two or three times a week. Because the menu changes all the time and the food is relatively light. And he keeps everything not inexpensive, but relatively inexpensive.
So I guess since it must be set up like a traditional Italian menu with antipasti and primi and secondi.
Yeah, it's definitely a three-course place, a four-course place if you get the cannoli for dessert, and hey, why not?
You have to get the cannoli.
But some of the antipasti I like a lot were something called pepperu, which I'd never seen before, which are a lot like those pickled red peppers that you can get in Italian delis, except these were super delicate, still crunchy, but they had a nice bright vinegar flavor and a sharpness, and you could really taste the vegetable that were stuffed with cheese, and there was a little bit of arugula with it.
Delicious.
So simple.
What else did you have?
He does a really nice sort of frittura, the small assortment of fried things that you get a lot in sort of mid-Italian restaurants with fried leeks and chickpea fritters in a really sort of light, almost tempura-ish batter. There's a gratin of beets that's just completely unlike anything I've ever had. They're sliced thinly, presumably with a mandolin, laid in sort of a metal, a cast iron dish, and zapped under a broiler with some Asiago cheese and a little bit of cream. And it's a big dish of creamed beets. Doesn't sound like something you'd be particularly interested in eating it, but there's a difference of flavor every bite. Some bites are really nutty, some bites are creamy, or some bites there's more of the beet sweetness. And before you know it, you're looking at a crock of beets that has been scraped clean. One of the things they're doing that should be unique to this restaurant is focaccina of Recco, which is a town in Liguria that does focaccia that's incredibly thin, paper thin, stretched over a table until it's basically the thickness of phyllo, which is to say almost nothing at all. And he stuffs those with a little bit of cheese and maybe some arugula, drizzle a little olive oil on top. That's it. It's so good.
It's completely addicting. I mean, you could just – I wanted to order another one as soon as I was finished with the first one.
There's three different kinds, one with – the plain one. There's one with anchovies, and there's one with mushrooms. And I keep wanting to try the other ones, but the first one is so good that I think it took me three or four visits before I actually got around to trying the anchovy one, which is utterly fantastic, by the way.
And okay, so now that we're completely filled with antipasti, let's move on to pasta.
And you can't eat another bite. His best pasta, I think, it's a handkerchief pasta, which is, again, very, very thin and very, very light and sort of crumpled like handkerchief would be on the dish. And he does a odd pesto I'd never seen before with almonds instead of the pine nuts. So it's sort of a khaki color instead of that, you know, bright, vivid green. But it's really fragrant and really delicious.
So good. Now, what about the more proteinaceous aspects of the menu, the flesh food?
The star of the menu has to be the porchetta, which isn't the most ambitious porchetta in town. It's just rolled pork belly with a little fennel pollen, actually with a lot of fennel pollen. But in its lusciousness and the intensity of the fennel, it might be the best porchetta I've ever had in Los Angeles.
Wow. That is thrown down the gauntlet.
I've eaten an awful lot of porchetta in Los Angeles. And this is just so delicious. There's that intensity there. There's the crispness, the sort of flabbiness that happens to porchetta sometimes isn't there. It's salty, but it's not over salty. Like everything here, it's a fairly modest portion, so it doesn't kill you like some porchettas you've had in town. But it's a beautiful piece of meat.
That sounds wonderful. And to finish, we have to have?
The cannoli are awful good there.
Really, really good.
They also, if you're like obsessed with obscure Italian coffee drinks, and who among us is not? It's the only place in town I've seen a bicerin, which is the drink from Torino, which is basically really good hot chocolate with a shot of espresso in it. I recommend that.
Yeah, I just love how he's really exploring the northern part of Italy for us. It's quite delicious.
He grew up, Bergamo, somewhere near Milan anyway. And his partner, the maitre d', is from Venice. And those aren't bad areas to have culinary influence from.
No, it's really nice. Refreshing. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, about Factory Kitchen in the Arts District in downtown LA. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and Jonathan's favorite dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on Good Food's restaurant map. It's on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Thanks to our team, Jillian, Laryl, Sarah, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food. We was on a dance floor, shaking our thing to a funky beat with a go-go swing. Everyone was like,